schedule constraints may be based on availability of staffing. It may also be based on the technology, okay? You know, I've got a technology that's almost there, and boy, I sure want this in my system, but I can't, but it's not quite there, so I'm going to delay this capability until the technology is ripe, and then I can put it in there, all right? And then later on down the line, what might happen is I've got a better piece of technology. Well, I want to take the old technology out and put new technology in. That's what happens when you have systems that are incrementally developed, and they have lengthy lifetimes, and they have extended development periods. So that was what was at issue here. How do we use this notion of capabilities, which, as I said, they weren't requirements, but they weren't needs either. In fact, capability, you know, there's something called the complexity gap, and that is right in between the needs, which is the domain space, the customer's space, it's the problem space. Usually it's expressed in terms of the user vernacular, okay, or the customer's vernacular. And sitting over here, you've got requirements. Well, they're in the solution space. Well, there's a big gap between those two. And what happens is, as you start moving across that gap, you start losing domain information. Okay, and it's called the complexity gap. Well, capabilities are positioned right in the middle, and we're going to see this. They're positioned right in the middle, so you make the jump from needs to capabilities, and then capabilities to requirements. All right, now, we hadn't made that jump from capability to requirements yet. It was enough for us to just be able to get to capabilities and understand what we were doing. Oops. Now, this is the capabilities engineering process. We start off with the needs. We develop some directives, which are low-level specifications, but these directives are then associated with capabilities. Now, we develop these capabilities. We use the notion of cohesion. We want these things to be highly cohesive, low-coupled, but also at the right level of abstractions for development. Okay? Now, at this point in time, when we started with needs and came to capabilities, this is as far as we really got. Now, we knew we had to come down here and then optimize these capabilities relative to scheduling constraints, technology advancements, and so forth. This really is a multidisciplinary optimization problem because we've got several things to consider. We've got cohesion, coupling, balance levels of abstraction, and then we want to be able to meet scheduling constraints and technologies. We're just beginning to look at this a little bit. So we wanted to optimize those and then make the jump and finalize the requirements. This bottom, what is happening here? Somebody got one of these back here and they're playing with me. I'll find out who you are. Okay, so it's really the second phase that we haven't completed yet. We're still working on. Now, cohesion. How did we do cohesion relative to these capabilities? Well, what we ended up doing is we took a functional decomposition graph or a needs graph. Okay, where the very top node, like this one right here, this is a mission statement. And it was decomposed down to the different needs. And then what we ended up doing was looking at, when we got down to the directives level, then what we ended up doing was saying, well, let's look at their relevance to contributing to the parent. Okay, and so we had these relevance values. If one of these had a catastrophic impact with respect to that function, you know, it was very, very relevant to it, very, very. So we use those as measures of functional cohesion, catastrophic, critical, marginal, and then we would just propagate them up. And so we would end up computing the different So we'd end up computing cohesion relative to for each one of these nodes. And these were the formulas that we used. Now, coupling was very similar. We had to compute the coupling between or among the different modules. And that coupling was, because what we really wanted to do was to minimize coupling. So what we ended up doing, we looked at the distance from the different directives, the difference from the different nodes and so forth. So this distance was proportional, the coupling was proportional to 1 over the distance and times the probability of change. Okay? And so we were able to determine what the coupling was between the different directives, as well as this relative to all the other nodes in that functional decomposition graph. Now, once we had that, once we had the coupling and cohesion measures, then what we now had to do was a little bit of trade-off analysis, because obviously the least coupled, most highly cohesive unit is your mission node. But that was out. I mean, we couldn't break it down and say, just give somebody, wham, here's the mission node. That's going to be your total decomposition. So what we wanted to be able to do now is come in and try to start pushing our level of abstraction down where we could identify these units that were highly cohesive, minimally coupled, but at the right level of development abstraction. And so it was a trade-off analysis of what we did as we came down, because as we went down here, the coupling increased, but as we went up, the size increased. So it was a little bit of a trade-off analysis. We had different kinds of scenarios that we had to worry about, where they were common coupled, like this A1 and A2 were common coupled with respect to A3. What did we do? We could break those links, put it over in one place, but each of those had different impacts. These were the easy ones to break. So we had to worry about the level of abstraction. So now we've got three things coming in here that we're having to do, and then what happens, this was one of the decomposition graphs that we looked at, or one of the functional decomposition graphs that we looked at. And so basically what it amounted to is what we computed was a slice across this, okay? And that slice pulled in these nodes that had the optimal cohesion and coupling collectively along with the right level of abstraction. And those were the capabilities then that we wanted to say, this is what you developed. And then in fact, we could give them an optimal sequence. You do this, and then this, and then this, and then this, if you want to maximize cohesion and minimize coupling. We tested this against Sakai. Sakai is it's kind of like a blackboard system. It's being developed by like 30 different universities and so forth, many different components of it. And we checked the change tolerance of it. We have said that, the change tolerance improves with the use of a CE-based design. We did a test against it. We were able to reject the null hypothesis, saying that the capability-based engineering had nothing to do with it, and accept the one that says it does improve with that. We also did a second study where we looked at change reduction. That is, if I use the capabilities engineering approach, I actually reduce the need for change, okay? And we were able to confirm that with a p-value of 0.002. So, yes. Oh, yes. 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 We had their design. We had a lot of the change requests that came through and so forth. We had to go in then and develop our CE design and then apply the same kind of we had their original need decomposition graph, we applied our CE design to it, and then looked at some of the, went and arbitrarily picked out some change requests that occurred and propagated them along ours. And how the CE design what? Yes, the RE design had already been done. Oh, we didn't even see it. No. I don't know that it would really made any difference, because what we ended up doing is we took the functional decomposition graph, which is the same one that they used, and then we applied the CE process to it, and it identified what these capabilities was in the decomposition, not us. And in some sense, what the nice thing about that is it starts giving us a high-level architecture. Okay, in terms of defining these pieces. Oh my gracious. I tell you, something ain't right here. Okay. Somebody back here going, they're getting giggles. Who's smiling out there? Okay, now. So we've worked with larger scale systems. How about smaller scale systems? What can we do there? You know, how can we apply this? I really started to get into this notion of agility. I thought it was really it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. I just thought it was really good, and I got enthused about it. So I started looking at agility, and had a graduate student, Ahmed Sidki, who really jumped on the bandwagon. He was really into it. And what we wanted to do was, and what he wanted to do was say, how can we actually go in and introduce, one of the problems that was occurring is that everybody and his brother was trying to jump on the bandwagon of agility. Oh man, I have an agile process, I call it sales. Well, what they were doing, they were taking practices that were supposed to address some of their problems and just throwing them into the current software development process. They had no idea how to really introduce agility in a way that it was forward looking. They had no idea what the downstream impact was going to be relative to introducing these, nor the dependencies among those different practices that you employed in agility. So what Ahmed did, he looked at that and he noticed that there was an absence of this structured approach to adopting these agile practices. So how do we address that? Well, Ahmed came up with a framework. It was a four-stage process as well as a measurement index. The four-stage process comes in and says, well, look, first of all, are there any discontinuing factors so that I can't go forward? And then I'm going to go in and I'm going to do a project-level assessment, and that's going to tell us something. In fact, a project-level assessment says, this is where I can aspire to, okay? But then, let me look down here at doing organizational assessment, and this is what the reality of the situation is, and then I have to balance the two some way. Either I lower my expectations of the project, or I make changes into an organization such that I can achieve the aspirations of the project level goals. And the way these two assessments were done was based on this measurement index. It was called a Sidki Agile Measurement Index, the SAMI. That was nice because it was his dad's name too. You know, so it was a compliment to his dad. So this then really is the four-stage process. And here's where the very first thing you do is say, are there any discontinuing factors? Now, like I said, we had this measurement index. We used Dr. Balchi's hierarchy of indicators concepts and tool, his EE tool, to be able to go in and do this type of assessment. It was built on that. So we would ask certain questions, and he did an absolutely phenomenal job in identifying what to ask and who to ask. Are there any discontinuing reasons? Or, you know, for example, the inappropriate need for agility, or I don't really have executive support. Okay, there's no money available to make this change. These are showstoppers. Well, if there are no showstoppers there, then let me go in and use this five-level process, which is in this index measurement. We'll see it here in just a second. And let me now assess the potential of my project based on certain characteristics. And then let me see what my organization itself can support. And then we would do what they call a gap analysis. We'd take these two in, do a gap analysis, and decide, you know, what we have to do. Do we have to lower the expectations of the project, or can we integrate some of the capabilities to raise the capability of an organization to work in an agile way? This, in fact, was the cornerstone of the measurement index. Here are the different levels, going up to level 5. These are the principles that's embraced by the agile community. Now, they really had 12 principles, but we were able to consolidate them into these 5. And these things in here are the different practices that support the achievement of these principles. And they are set in a way that reflects dependencies, okay? Now, it's not quite as simple as that because we're in the process of working on what they call value-driven agile adoption, where this is used as a foundation, but then we have to go in and look at the organization, and it may modify a little bit relative to the organization, and then we have to look at that relative to the business objectives, and it may also change some of these. And we'll see here in just a second that not everyone agreed with us on these. We then took the SAMI and the framework, and Ahmed traveled all over the country talking to the big boys in Agile. And that was easy to do because it's relatively new, and going to the conference, the Agile conferences, is just, I mean, you're rubbing shoulders with everybody. It's a lot of fun. It's just probably one of the most fun conferences I've ever been to. But in the process, when we looked at the four-stage process, and I'll really point out over here, when we looked at the leading people that had 6 years of experience leading this notion of agile adoption, these strongly agreed with the understandability, practicality, necessity, completeness, and effectiveness of this four-stage process. We were very pleased to see that. Now, as I said, different people took different approaches to the way that they would do these practices. Maybe one would, thought, I want to use this particular practice first. And so we got a little bit more dissension over here when we were looking at this measurement index, but still we were quite pleased. 80% strongly agreed that it was understandable. 80% agreed that it was practical. The necessity and the completeness, and it looks like I've lost the bar. What is this? With respect to completeness and effectiveness, then we started losing a little bit of the, because they wanted to see it done in a different way, is what it amounted to, which was perfectly fine. And that's where we decided, wait a minute, maybe just what we presented as being the end-all, be-all one SAMI isn't it. Maybe we need to be able to change it based on organizational cultures, for example, or business objectives, which really were the complaints that were coming back by these people over here. And I think they're exactly right. And so we are in the process of now working for value-driven agile adoption. Now, most recently, one of the other problems with requirements was this notion of, I don't know if you've ever seen security requirements. I haven't. They're almost non-existent in terms of security requirements. And I mean requirements that are testable, that state this is exactly what should be done. This is how the system works, and it is a testable requirement. What you almost always see from a security perspective, or have in the past in particular, is that they were stated as negative requirements, untestable, unverifiable. A negative requirement like, the system shall not be compromised over the internet. Now, how do you test that? But yet, those were requirements that we were seeing. So, Anil Bazaz, he went out and he started looking at security issues. And he went out to sites that had all these exploits on them, and he started looking at those exploits. And he said, we can come up with a taxonomy here that will help us. And that taxonomy is a taxonomy of vulnerabilities. Looking at these exploits, I can see where these systems are vulnerable, okay? I can pull back and decide, here are some vulnerabilities. And those vulnerabilities, as it turns out, are constraints and assumptions that are violated during the time of development. So let me identify those things, and not let me just have them all in one huge clump. There's a way I can organize these in this taxonomy. And we did that. But then that wasn't quite enough. For example, dynamic memory was one of the organizational elements in this taxonomy. But that wasn't quite enough. If I really want to be able to get some V&V strategies, which was really the ultimate goal of what we wanted to do, define some V&V strategies such that I could test a piece of software, a product, and try to assess to what extent it is secure, to be able to evolve these strategies, I not only knew what was being violated, what constraint or assumption being violated, but what were the objects that were sitting over here being exploited. I needed both of those things to be able to devise some good V&V strategies. And that's what Anil did. He came up with this taxonomy. This was the taxonomy of vulnerabilities. You know, what are the different vulnerabilities out there? And the bottom line, we saw them in dynamic memory, static memory, network interfaces, file systems, randomness resources, and cryptographic algorithms. And he got this decomposition. This was based on our object model of computing, as we're going to see. But there were 13 constraints and assumptions that if you violated those down here in dynamic memory, then you are susceptible to exploit if you violate any one of them. And so there were two here, five, 10, blah, 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 blah. All right, now, so we had the taxonomy, but if we're really going to be able to build these V&V strategies, just knowing what the exploits are is not quite enough. I've got to build in what is being exploited. Like, for example, the buffer overflow. You know, that's where you go in, you know, you're in dynamic memory, and somebody doesn't check a buffer there. You start writing something to that buffer, maybe it's an input buffer, and you put code in there, you overlay on the stack the return address, and you have that return address point back to the beginning of the buffer where your code is. So when it returns from the procedure, it doesn't go back to the procedure. It goes up to the space up in D space, in your data space up to the buffer, and it starts executing that. Well, lo and behold, that person's running your code. So anyway, you had to know what the objects were. So we had this object model of computing that where it allowed us to identify the objects that actually were being exploited. Whoops, 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 whoops. Well, let me see. I don't know what's happening here. I'm going to have to undo this and start this. I'll get there real quick. Okay, so that was the taxonomy, the process object model of computing, and then this was our object model structure. And the objects that we found in dynamic memory, there were five, there were three, there were two over here in the network interface, two in the file system. And so these were the actual objects that were objects of exploit. So we then brought those two together and started developing V&V strategies, knowing the constraint assumption that was being violating, knowing the object that was being attacked, and pull those together and started defining V&V strategies that could later be refined based on the application that you're in, started defining V&V based strategies that allowed us to apply V&V to that. There were 46 of these based strategies in terms of what we identified. Now, this was from a security perspective. We then built on his work. Whoops, yes. Now, I'm coming into my end mode here. We've got some current initiatives going on here. Jveta Sondran, she just finished up her master's where she was doing a soft structured approach to Agile. Believe it or not, you know, it's amazing what you see. Even the people that are out in the Agile world, their Agile the requirements engineering process has no framework, no structure to it. All they have is just a bunch of principles and practices, but it tells you no way how to go about doing it. So Jveta devised this soft structured approach, and it had to be soft structured because those people do not like constraints, I'll tell you. They don't like documentation. You know, there are a lot of things that we find to be advantageous in the conventional approach, and they do away with a lot of it. But they do it in a way that it doesn't really destroy the process. So anyway, we wanted to structure it a little bit. Jveta went in there and did a nice job with respect to this. And now what she's beginning to look at is how do I determine the quality of the process and the product in this from an Agile perspective. And there are a lot of issues there, part of which is that there's not a lot of structure in the process itself. We do have the Scrum process, but it's kind of like the RGM. You know, it guides you, it gives you a wide boundary. You can use a lot of different methods. You can bounce back and forth, but it kind of guides you just a little bit. So we do have a little bit to build on. Lee Claggett and Bo Fraser are working from a security standpoint. They're building on the work that Anil did, Anil Bazaar did. Anil, by the way, is working, as a matter of fact, he's He's working on security of Vista at Microsoft. But we came out with something called access-driven VVNT. What we want to be able to do is to take those constraints and assumptions, refine those, in fact, in down to requirements that we can say, this is a requirement, meaning it's testable. And this is, and in fact, Lee is doing is he's building a nice little tool that says, if I have this capability, then I need to look at these kind of requirements. If I had this capability, look at these kind of requirements. So it's almost like, hey, you know, let me at least consider these things, okay? And what they both are working on is this access-driven VVNT, and that is, how do I implement verification, validation, and testing, and it's driven based on what access I have to the software development effort itself. There's full VVNT, that is, I'm in there at the beginning of the process, and I can influence the requirements. Oh, that would be wonderful. Or there's partial VVNT, where I've got all the documentation, but the product's built. And then there's in-game VVNT, which is, oh man, all I've got the binary. How do I tell to what extent that's secure? Okay? So, and this also stems from IV and V work. So people, what can I say? Well, I'll tell you what I can say. And it's this. We are the proud. We are the few. We are the software engineers. Okay? Now, but when the truth is told, we're all software engineers. You think about what everyone does in this department. We build products. We build a theory behind them. And it takes all that to really software engineer. And you know, I give the HCI people a tough time. You know, but we got to have HCI too. All right? I mean, for the interface kind of stuff. So anyway, I can't say anything about quite right. We are all software engineers, and I'll leave it at that. I guess I have 5 minutes for questions. Seeing none, we'll close this. Thank you. No, go ahead. Thank you. I do have a lot of ideas if some of you want to come and talk to me on some of this stuff. Gosh, it's wonderful. It's amazing. It's neat. The main differences with the Agile community has to do, they have a totally different process, they have a totally different set of practices, and they are almost in opposition to conventional software engineering, because they want to throw documentation away.